From back home in Studio F, high atop Five Bush Media World Domination Headquarters, it is the Top of the Tower podcast. I'm Scott Feibusch. Welcome back for another week. We've got a big one for you this week. We are back from a couple of traveling events, the radio show in Austin, which we'll talk about in just a moment, and also our good friend Bob Gilmore in Connecticut does a radio barbecue every 3 years, and we had the chance not only to go and enjoy the company there and even get on the air a little bit, but also to sit down with some very interesting radio people who you'll be hearing from both in this episode and in upcoming episodes of the Top of the Tower podcast. But let's get started in Austin. If you were expecting lots of major news to come out of the radio show this year, well, A, you probably haven't been to a radio show in recent years. They tend not to produce a lot of major breaking news. And this one in particular was a relatively quiet one, in part, I think, because a lot of attention was not in Austin, but rather down the road in Houston, where they were continuing to recover at that point from the devastation, as they are continuing to recover from the devastation of Harvey. And then also over in South Florida, a lot of broadcast people, both current and retired, are in South Florida. A number of the vendors at the show have bases in South Florida and had to bug out early to get home to make sure that everything was going to be okay for them there. There was obviously a lot of worry about what would happen in the days and weeks ahead. Our flight home got delayed because of it. And so there was not necessarily a lot of news being made, but there were a few areas that were interesting. So let's talk about some of what came out of the show. There was, as you would expect, a lot of discussion about digital media, about interactive media, a lot of discussion in particular about making sure that radio has a place in the personal assistant realm, about making sure that radio does everything that it can do to show up prominently on, for instance, your Alexa or, for instance, on your Apple device. And so a lot of best practices being shared about how to make sure that stations are well-positioned for that world. We'll talk to some of the experts about that topic in upcoming weeks of the podcast, too, if you're interested. There was discussion, as you would imagine, about the TV repack and about what effect that's going to have on FM broadcasters. And let's be honest here. I mean, there was a very well-attended presentation that we attended talking about how stations, if they are located on a TV tower or in a TV farm for their FM facility, need to be aware that there are going to be some disruptions coming up and need to be prepared for that, ideally with an off-site aux location. It would seem to me, and this now we're getting into the commentary side of things here, it would seem to me that any station that is in a position like that, and typically they are larger market stations, should have been doing this due diligence years ago. Really should have realized years ago, and I think a lot of them did, that they were going to be disrupted by this, and that they were going to have some place to go while this work was going on TV towers. And so that perhaps could be one reason why some of the vendors that we talked to weren't necessarily hearing a lot of immediate orders coming in, because these have been trickling in for a few years. The stations that are smart about this, and there are plenty of stations out there that are smart about this, have been preparing these auxiliary facilities for years. And we're getting to the point now where if you're in a position like this and you don't have an aux site going, you better get that into your CapEx budget for the next year or two if you can, because this is coming down the pike. Probably not quite as fast as the FCC thinks it is, but it's coming down the pike. Speaking of coming down the pike, one thing that is moving more slowly perhaps than we anticipated is the next set of FM translator windows. Of course, we know that about 1,100 AM stations filed applications with the FCC in that window in July and August to add FM translators. About 1,000 of those were valid applications. We think about 200 of those are going to end up in mutually exclusive or MX groups where they can't both be granted at the same time without causing interference to one another. But we are still waiting on the FCC to actually come out and give us a list of those groups, and then also to tell us, okay, here are the remaining 800 or so stations. You guys are singletons. Go ahead, file the rest of your application, and we'll go ahead and grant you. We had kind of hoped, and here I'm wearing my consulting hat from Feibusch Media because we help stations in this process, and we can help yours too. We were kind of hoping that at this point we would be busy filing those applications and starting to get some of these stations closer to getting on the air. It's not happening yet. Apparently the FCC is having some software bugs that are delaying this implementation. So we wait a little bit longer on this. The word now is that we're probably into October, maybe even November, before we actually start getting these singleton lists coming out and before we start understanding what these MX groups will be and how quickly they will go to auction. And, of course, that then gets us into the next question of, Okay, how fast can the rest of the AM stations in the country, all the Class A and B AMs that do not yet have translators out of this window process, and then whatever remaining C's and D's might not have applied and still want to take a stab at it, how fast will they have a window to open? Again, we'd kind of hoped that that window would come before the end of this year. It is not coming before the end of this year, apparently. The latest that we're hearing is sometime in early 2018, but that auction process has to wrap up first. So there are a lot of moving pieces here from the FCC. This process looks like it will drag on for rather longer than we had originally anticipated. So we keep waiting on that. We will, of course, keep you apprised on what's happening here on the Top of the Tower podcast. Another shoe that did not drop in Austin. We are still waiting for that big CBS Entercom spinoff deal to be announced. Where are those stations going that Entercom has to spin off? What are the stations that Entercom will end up having to spin off? We look, for instance, to Boston and the situation there where they have both of the big sports radio franchises in town and may have to get rid of one or the other. We'll certainly have to get rid of at least some of their properties. We had kind of hoped that maybe this would be a nice opportunity for those companies to make a big public announcement in front of the radio community about what was happening with them. Not this time. So we will wait for that to happen. Hopefully in the next few weeks. Again, of course, that will be a big story here on the Top of the Tower when we get there. It was a good time in Austin, though. There was concern by some of the vendors that engineers wouldn't show up because they had just been in Austin for the Texas Association of Broadcasters. There was a pretty good turnout considering it. It's easy to get people to Austin. It's a fun city to be in. We had a chance to take a walk down Congress Street and see the bats coming out of the bridge at sunset. That was neat. And to eat a lot of good food and catch up with friends. You'll be hearing a little bit more of that and some interviews coming up on Top of the Tower in the months to come. We will be back in a moment with the latest on what's happening in Florida and some emergency preparedness thoughts from some of the experts in the field. First, though, we want to make sure that you are well aware of what is happening with the 2018 Tower Site Calendar. It is coming back from the printer. We got the early preprint versions back. They look good. A lot of great pictures there for you. It will be shipping in the next couple of weeks. So if you go to fibush.com and scroll down to the store and click on the calendar, you can be one of the first to get your 2018 Tower Site Calendar delivered to you. It's an important part of supporting what we do here at Fibush Media, and we always look forward to the support of the broadcast industry and continuing to put this product out. So if you want broadcast tower calendars to continue in the years to come, please go ahead and show your support right now by buying that 2018 edition. Back in a moment.
Love me, baby. Hey, it's the Big Tuna, Jim K here at Totally 70s. A Saturday night at the barbecue disc jockey reunion party. What a great time we've had today. Hope you've enjoyed been listening to all the superstars here that have been on the show. This one takes us back to the summertime of 1968. One of my all-time favorite rock and roll records. Ted Nugent was in this band when he was just a teenager. It's the Amboy Dukes. Journey to the center of the mind. It's psychedelic. It's Totally 70s. Yes, sir!
Well, it was just a little snippet of the broadcast that was originating from Bob Gilmore's basement high on a hilltop in Connecticut on Saturday night as he hosted his triennial radio barbecue. It was broadcast out to the world on WRMI shortwave down in Florida, which, of course, was having potential issues of its own at that point as they awaited the arrival of Hurricane Irma. As it turns out, they mostly just lost power there and were able to get back up and running. But while we were at the barbecue, we sat down with Mike Erickson of Wheatstone, a longtime friend of this podcast and of the column, and had a chance to get some of his thoughts on what radio stations ought to be thinking about with emergency preparedness when a big storm is bearing down on them.
Let's talk a little bit about some of the things from an engineering point of view, and in your case also, you know, working with a manufacturer. What are some of the things that you tell clients to be ready for in situations like this?
I mean, redundancy is always key, sometimes double and triple. Here's the problem. A lot of people don't end up understanding it until they've actually experienced it. So a lot of the stations that you see in hurricane areas that may not have had a hurricane for a few decades, you know, have let some of these systems like generators and, you know, maybe a backup studio, backup antenna and transmitter. A lot of these places sometimes let those things go by the wayside, and then you end up having a storm, and then all of a sudden you have religion about it. And you prepare for the next one. So hopefully the proper preparations have been taken, you know, to make sure that there's backup plans if you need to evacuate people. Unfortunately, we had a we've already seen this a couple of weeks ago with Harvey in Houston and what happened to the TV station down there. And, you know, you had engineering competitors working together to help each other. And that's probably going to end up happening here in South Florida as well. But, you know, having your own backup plan in case for some reason the competitor is also in that same situation, you know, the more resources you have, the better off you're going to be.
And you've been in some of these situations. I mean, you're from Long Island originally. You've dealt with this there. You're living now in eastern North Carolina, which has been in the path of these. How do you get through, especially if you're dealing with ownership that isn't necessarily in these areas? And in these days where everything has to be justified for cost, how do you make that case that this is cost effective to make these preparations ahead of time, to have the generators, the hardened facilities, the aux sites, to be ready for something like this?
In hurricane zones, it's easier to make it. And when I was working in New York, it's a little bit harder because they don't see the immediate return on investment because they're saying, you know, we get a storm every 15, 20 years. It's not my problem. Kick the can down the road. We have some resources in place as backups, but, you know, not like we probably really should. Funny thing is I left CBS in New York before Sandy, and when the big blackout happened, and I think it was 2003, I was actually on vacation. I was actually sitting in Camden Yards getting ready to watch I think it was the Orioles and the Yankees were playing, and they were showing it on the big screen down there that, you know, New York City and the whole Northeast and, you know, Ontario were all had lost power. And I watched the game, and early the next morning I ended up heading back. A fan had a generator, but there was a resistance by some people in management, not on the engineering side, I'll say, to load test the generator often enough to ensure that it would work. And when the blackout happened, sure enough, tried to put the generator on, didn't happen. So FAN programming was actually kind of taken care of. We carried the Yankee game that night when the fan was not the Yankee affiliate yet. We carried the Yankee game that night while WCBS continued coverage of what was going on. The blackout. After the Yankee game was over, we were able to, at the transmitter site, patch 88 on the air, so 66 and 88 simulcast until Imus in the morning, which we got ISDN audio set up back from MSNBC, and we were able to get it on that way. And somehow, I don't know how they managed it, because I was still traveling back when that happened, but they managed to get spots on, and then they did actually talk shows from the transmitter site, the studio in the transmitter site, for the remainder of the day until power was finally restored late in the afternoon to Kauffman. And then we moved back the next night, and I think there was another. The Mets finally were playing the Giants, and they finally got the game on, and you know, we were able to do it out of the main studio almost 24 hours after the power had gone out.
And, of course, in New York City radio, every minute of lost revenue counts.
Oh, yeah. Every minute definitely counts. I think we aired a best of – when the power went out, if I recall correctly, I think they aired a best of Imus till the Yankee game, and they had that at the transmitter site ready to go on a CD. So they aired that until the Yankee game started. So there was some lost revenue, and the Yankee game was pulled in over ISDN. They still produced it at the broadcast center, which is where WCBS was at the time. We just took the game in over ISDN at the High Island, which did have full generator and stayed on the air.
And so you're dependent, too, on connectivity, which may not exist in a lot
right,
of these circumstances.
Right, but it did. It did, thankfully. It did.
And that was something interesting from Houston. You know, we tend to think that the common wisdom has always been the streaming's going to go away right away. Nobody's going to have access to data coverage to be able to get access to streaming services, and a lot of people in the Houston area still did.
Yes, they did. And there was for the type of catastrophe it was, there was a lot of people who still maintained power, and in fact, unfortunately, it led to some people, you know, dying because they were in water where power lines and were still active. So it was a curse and a blessing at the same time. But there was access to streaming. You know, the battery backups in the central offices where the ISDN circuits were in were working long enough that it let us do the Yankee game and, you know, let us get into overnight simulcasting 88 you know, before we had to worry about that in the morning. So,
coming at this now on the manufacturing end of things, what kind of capacity is there? You know, if studios, God forbid, do get destroyed in this, if people need emergency equipment now, you know, talk both from the Wheatstone point of view and also just from the industry in general, what sort of resources are out there to help people rebuild quickly?
Well, I mean, the nice part about being in a big company like iHeart or Entercom or CBS or Cumulus is that you do have resources from other markets. And a lot of companies do, when they tear out old studios, some stuff does ends up going to storage and ends up getting, you know, sent out for people who have emergencies. You know, I need a console, I need a transmitter, I need something, and they can do it. A lot of our vendors gear up for that too, like BSW, 305 Broadcast, SCMS. They'll be geared up and ready. And, you know, we have consoles in stock for people who might need an inexpensive mixer to bridge the gap until they can find a place to set up a permanent studio. So all that is in play, and, you know, you can call one of our dealers. If you need something after the storm, you know, they can get it to you. You know, that stuff they keep in stock, or they can drop ship it right from our facility in North Carolina, where it doesn't look like we're going to get much of the effects. I think they're saying 1 to 2 inches of rain, no wind, and that's it. So we dodged a bullet. Unfortunately, not everyone has.
I know we've seen on the transmitter end of things in circumstances like this, a BE or a Nautel might have something that they're getting ready for a customer who might not need it right that second.
Right.
That can be diverted to somebody who's off the air and desperately needs it.
They'll fast track that. We saw that with Katrina with a lot of that. And that also led to iHeart, I believe, was the one that came up with that mobile radio facility where they can actually just drive it to where it's needed and put it on the air. You know, at least get one of the stations back on the air with serving the community in a time of need where radio becomes, you know, a vital key. You know, not just the streaming, but we're going to see at this storm, there's going to be massive power failure. So it's going to be radios with batteries. And, you know, radio then becomes the only source. Cell phone towers, that infrastructure is going to be heavily damaged. Telephone, heavily damaged. Cable, heavily damaged. Over-the-air radio. You know, that's going to be it. And, you know, it's unfortunate. I was talking to a colleague of mine about this. You know, you go into a store like Walmart or, you know, Best Buy, you can't find a little portable radio. All the portable radios are, you know, iPod docking stations or come with something else, and a lot of them are not. Some of them are rechargeable battery powered, and that's kind of a problem at a time like this because the charge is good for a few hours. But radios that have, you know, AA or C or D batteries, they're hard to find.
You know what else
stores.
Is getting hard to find? I don't see as many of the crank radios around as you saw a few years ago.
Well, a lot of that is Radio Shack. Radio Shack was the one that sold those emergency radios. And I was reading an article today. They're down to, I think, under 40 corporate-owned stores. And the rest of them are now franchises. So you just can't go to Radio Shack and buy a crank radio. It's kind of sad that, you know, in an emergency like this, you need the little Sony 9-volt battery radio, and they're nowhere to be found unless you're lucky enough to have it all.
Which makes it harder for broadcasters then to make the case of keep your radio when you're in your go bag.
Right. Well, this would be a good promotion for radio stations in hurricane prone areas as a prize. Have a bunch of radios, you know, little portable radios made up, like giveaway emergency kits. You can give them away at fairs. You have a flashlight, you know, that runs on AA batteries, and you have a radio that maybe you put the station's brand on it, 9-volt radio that, you know, you give away at it. It's a good investment.
Always thinking, Mike Erickson.
No.
Always thinking.
No.
All right. Thanks for talking with us on Top of the Tower.
Good to see you.
And by the way, if you would like to hear a scoped-down version of that entire 3-hour broadcast out of Bob Gilmore's basement, a lot of top-notch radio pros were taking part in it that night. It lives exclusively over at airchecks.com. That's AIRCHEXX.com. Airchecks with two X's. And we also had a chance to sit down and chat with Airchecks' proprietor, Steve West. You'll be hearing that conversation coming up soon on Top of the Tower podcast. We stay focused, however, right now on Irma. And as the storm was just starting to bear down on Florida Sunday morning, we had a chance to also sit down with one of the real experts in disaster preparedness and recovery and broadcast continuity planning, Howard Price. Let's listen to some of that conversation.
So as we're recording this, we're sitting in a diner in safe, sunny upstate New York. And we're looking at the coverage that's coming right now from down in Florida. What should broadcasters be learning right now from what we saw last week in Houston and what we're seeing now in Florida and what looks like a particularly devastating season? What should everybody be thinking about right now?
Well, Scott, I think that what we're seeing here is a very clear demonstration of why planning is more important than a plan. You know, what you hear so often in our industry and so many other industries is, well, you got to have a plan. You got to have a plan, and that's true. You do. You need a documented course of action. You need to see where your gaps are, and you need to see the resources that you need, and have a process, an organized process for implementing them. But I've always said that the planning is more important than the plan. I think when you take a look at Harvey, and certainly now with Irma, you see that you got to be ready to zag when something else zigs. The problem with focusing on the plan, that is a document, is that too often those documents become static. The resourcing behind them becomes unchanged. And you lose your flexibility and you lose your adaptability. So I guess the real walkaway for me is concentrate on the process that develops your plan and keep it elastic.
One thing that I'm seeing as I'm reading some comments from some of my friends who are in the midst of it right now in Florida is that I'm kind of getting the impression that there were thoughts put into, you know, hardening facilities, making sure generators are fueled, all that sort of thing. And that it seems like sometimes things get lost with the people themselves and realizing, okay, if you're working in, let's say, Miami, or if you're working in Fort Myers, you're thinking about your own home, you're thinking about your own family, what your evacuation plans are. What should people who are doing this kind of planning process be thinking about for their people?
Well, there's a whole new arena. It's actually not new, but it's received much more attention now. It's called compassionate care. And there's an inward facing portion of that and an external facing portion of that. If you are in a client business, then you have to worry about taking care of clients. If you are in a business operation, you have to worry about taking care of your own people. If you talk to the folks at WWL, they'll tell you that during Katrina, one of the things at that time that they had not planned adequately enough for was all the family members of the staff that came in to bunker at the station. And they now have a plan for that. We're probably going to see some of that now with Hurricane Irma. Certainly that was the case with Hurricane Harvey. So you have to take care of the physical needs in order to keep the people that you need in place and on the air or out in the field. They need to know that their families are taken care of. So there's that piece. The other piece are the people themselves, your staff. They're going to see and feel and experience things that will leave them traumatized. They may see their own homes damaged or destroyed. They may see a sharp rise in loss of life. We live in a technological age. Now imagine not having electrical power, not just for a couple of hours or a couple of days, but we're hearing figures of weeks, possibly months, and this is in 21st century America. Imagine how we rely on electricity. Imagine what that does to you when you're suddenly thrust back in time where the electricity just isn't there or wasn't as reliable as it is now. So, yes, you have to have some sensitivity to that. And again, during the disaster, as with all of these things, during the disaster is not the time to plan for it. These are the considerations that you have to blue sky. I like telling people, have a big whiteboard and think about all the things, random, stream of consciousness, all the things that you might have to do and need during a disaster or after, and just write them all on the board and then organize them in terms of the way you have to prioritize them.
And we tend to think of these things, you know, the news cycle moves on, you already don't see anything about Harvey on TV, but there's certainly lots of long-term devastation that's going to take a look at.
if you are planning for these things, how do you plan then not only for the immediate, okay, what are we going to do when the storm is hitting, but how do you make the case, you know, especially to a corporate owner in this day and age, we need to think about preparing for this then as something that can last for months or years?
Right. So one of the things that I tell folks that I speak with about this in the industry is disaster, although we don't really want to couch it this way, it truly is sellable. And you sell it from a public service point of view. You sell it to insurance companies. You sell it to underwriters. You sell it to adjusters. You sell it to legal businesses. You sell it to bankers. You sell it to the cell phone companies, the folks that sell SUVs. They want to be part of that image, and they need to get their messages out because these are the assets, the resources that the community is going to need to use and be aware of in order to recover from the disaster. So to get back to your original question, how do you sell it to corporate? The first question corporate's going to ask is, well, look, you know, we certainly want to do our public bit, but who's going to pay for this? I just told you how to pay for it. And you line all, again, it's like everything else, you line all of this up very much the way radio and TV stations used to sell school closings. You know, you never knew at the beginning of the season whether it was going to snow or how much, so you did a contingency sell. And if the spots ran, this is what the client got billed, and there was your money. And if the spots didn't run, you at least got them, got a little bit of money from them for the promotional announcements that told you that their service was going to be available. I say that that's the way you have to approach this. That then gives you the wherewithal to then go and commit staff, maybe incur a little bit of overtime, to send folks into the affected communities to do the sidebar stories, the third, the fourth, the fifth day, week, month stories, and to make this an ongoing series. By the way, you then have a great package that you can submit for awards, and that just bolsters and burnishes your brand, which allows you to go back out into the community and sell again.
Which means, in turn, that your sales department can't just bug out when the storm is coming, right?
And that's really interesting. One story that I heard some time ago at an industry conference was the story of the lessons learned by a cluster of stations that had been hit very hard by a hurricane. And they said that what they learned was they needed to get sales ramped up quickly because there were people that needed to be on the air. The sales force needed a viable workspace. They needed connectivity. They needed phones. And they needed to be able to deal with clients and actually get them on the air.
Interesting. Let's talk a little about radio versus TV, because there's a tendency that we see in a lot of clusters to say, okay, we don't have a news department. When the worst of this hits, we're going to hand it over to the TV station and just simulcast their audio, and that's not always necessarily the best plan, right?
Well, look, you are going to get tremendous coverage from TV. I am not at all dismissing that as a viable programming option, but I think it needs to be part of a mix of resources. If we take a look at some of the positives of consolidation, one of them is that you have stations that are part of large groups, maybe not within a single community, but across the whole of the United States. You've got other stations with people. There should be a protocol in place at any group-owned operation to be able to call in the cavalry, to be able to bring people in from other markets to help bolster your own staff. Again, part of the planning, okay, in advance of an event. You know that under any circumstances, your people locally are going to be exhausted, they're going to be traumatized, they're going to be running on fumes, they need a break, not only for their own physical health, but for their own mental health. And you can't just drop the story. You've got to be able to bring people in, bring a fresh set of eyes and ears. And again, you know, this now becomes something that that becomes part of a corporate mission, a corporate philosophy. And I think at the end of the day, it creates lessons learned that these people can then bring back to their own stations and bolster their resilience within their markets.
And later on, then, if you need reciprocal help, you know where to get it.
Well, that's exactly right. You know, it creates a skill set also that I think sends people back to their markets as better reporters, better managers, because they're now really ready for anything.
Technologically, we've always worked under the assumption that, you know, if a hurricane is hitting, at some point the TV stations will be off the air, people don't have power, can't see them, they're going to have to come back and depend on good old broadcast radio, and especially on AM. Is that still the case? Have we seen, you know, it seemed especially with Harvey, that people managed to keep their wireless connectivity up and were able to get information that way that maybe 5 or 10 or 20 years ago they wouldn't have been able to. What's changing that way?
Well, what we saw in Harvey was that 95%, roughly 95% of Houston's cellular system stayed up. So you've got pretty good connectivity there. But remember, you are going to also have heavier usage. So, you know, streaming speeds are going to slow down, certainly for video. There will be occasions where it may take you a little while to get a signal through to a cell site. The lessons I think that we're learning as we take a look at technology is, first of all, text takes way less bandwidth than audio. So we need to get our texting game up. You know, a lot of radio stations use texting for marketing. You should be able to incorporate those procedures as part of your emergency plan by texting out information to client to audiences and clients, very much the same way you would text out a promotional message or a giveaway. So that's the first thing. In terms of the cellular system and the use of IP, look, these systems, there's no question these systems have become more resilient, and they are absolutely a key part of our arsenal. But let's not forget good old RF. There's an old saying that radio works when nothing else does, and I fully believe that. I'm a ham radio operator, and that's actually where the saying comes from. Ham radio works when nothing else does. But radio in general works when nothing else does. So where are the weak spots in the armor? The weak spots in the armor are that I would dare say that the vast majority of smaller market stations certainly don't have generators. And if they do, they may only have a generator to transmit. Well, what do you do? Well, I guess what you have to do is build a backup studio at your transmitter, because that's going to be your fallback position. I don't believe that we do enough to leverage our relationships with emergency managers. You know, most EOCs, emergency operations centers, have very robust buildings and plenty of backup power and some pretty good connectivity, too. So why not make a deal with your local EOC and say, make us the official emergency station in exchange for allowing us to operate in your facility as a backup facility? So I think that there are many, many ways that we can leverage both the improvement in technology and still emphasize the importance of our old technology in order to create the best of both worlds for our listeners and our clients.
And there are a lot of those best practices out there to learn from. You mentioned with the emergency management. I have a friend who does engineering for a very small cluster of stations. It's sort of halfway between Jacksonville and Daytona. And that's exactly what they did. They are set up. You know, as it turns out, they got spared the worst of it, it looks like. But they are set up with a studio at the Emergency Management Center that they can go live to at any moment. There's a microphone there that any of the emergency personnel in the county can go to and can get right on the air like that. So we, you know, obviously on this podcast, we're going to try to get word out there. What else, you know, if somebody is listening from a smaller station to say, I want to learn more about this, what are the resources? Who do they talk to?
Well, they can certainly, you know, call me. I maintain a website called MediaDisasterPrep.com. My reach information is listed there. People can certainly call me, and I'll be happy to talk with them and give them some guidance. But I'm going to tell you something, Scott. I want to kick this back to the industry, because I think the industry needs to concentrate on what its unique competencies are, and I think disaster response is one of them. And I think we need to take that more seriously. We need to realize that we can generate income from our preparedness image and our reliability image that will in turn create a cycle of self-funding these very expensive kinds of resource allocations. I'd like to see our state broadcaster associations take this more seriously, make this a standard part of their member services offering, so that within each state, planning resources specific to the risks of that state are communicated and taught and provided for in some way to the to the members. I think it's a great service to provide. And again, that's something I'm happy to talk about with any state broadcaster association.
Arranging emergency access. I know in Texas, for instance, that's been a big issue with making sure that people have the right IDs that FEMA will respect so they can get access to fuel and access to get through to where they need to go to maintain a transmitter site, for instance.
Well, that's correct. And that's really, one of the top pieces of advice I give anybody. And that is, first of all, understand that certainly since Katrina and since 9/11, the federal government has felt that the communications infrastructure of the United States is considered a critical national security interest. And that gives you some leverage to go to your emergency planners, your utilities, and say, we need to be at the top of the priority list for power restoration, for fuel delivery, for key delivery of operating resources, et cetera. The other thing that you need to do, I think, is support any efforts within your state broadcasters association to lobby for a federal first informer bill. I know that there are several states that have done it on their own. I think that's marvelous, but I think this has to be a matter of national priority. Press your state broadcaster associations to press the NAB, the RTDNA, all of the groups that represent radio and television informational interests to press for this bill. It's very, very important.
And this would be a bill that would essentially mandate that broadcasters have priority to get what they need to get in terms of fuel and access, that sort of thing?
Well, right. And in some cases, the access is almost as important because when cordons go up in neighborhoods, we can't do very good reporting if we can't see what's going on. So the ability to have this so-called first informer status that in areas without well-organized media management, by local police agencies would create a national framework that any police or fire department or emergency management organization could use to manage the way reporters are given access to emergencies and also to the resources.
Howard Price, the website again is?
MediaDisasterPrep.com.
Thanks so much.
Well, since we recorded that conversation on Sunday morning, we have at least a few updates that we can bring you from what's happening in Florida. Right now, the big mystery area, at least as we record this on Tuesday morning, is the Keys. There is still very little communication coming to us from anywhere in the Keys. Power is still out for pretty much the entire Florida Keys. From what we understand, most radio stations are off the air, and we simply don't have a lot of on-scene reporting yet from the Keys as to what the status is of those broadcast facilities there. There are a couple of major multi-user FM tower sites that are right in that mid-Keys area that got hit the hardest as Irma came through, and we're still waiting to find out if those towers are even still standing, what the status is of the equipment there. Further up in Florida, we know that there were lots of power outages that took a lot of stations off the air. Beasley, for instance, has been doing a good job of keeping us informed of what's been happening at some of their broadcast clusters, for instance, in the Fort Myers-Naples area, where their stations, at least as of Tuesday morning, largely remained off the air, mostly just due to power outages, but in some cases some more serious situations that may require some transmitter equipment to be replaced. We have not heard yet of a lot of towers actually down, which says that the current version of tower loading standards seems to be working pretty well, we think. We haven't heard yet a lot of in-depth reports about what damage might be from just saltwater incursion and that sort of thing at tower sites, and we haven't heard a lot of word about studio damage either. So we will be keeping an ear on that, and we will be keeping you informed here at Top of the Tower. And, of course, our thoughts go out to broadcasters in South Florida. If there is anything that we can do to help them, we'd love to pass that information along to you here on the Top of the Tower podcast and over at FiveWish.com. A reminder, if you want to see the before pictures of what broadcasting in Florida looked like before the storms hit, we compiled all of our pictures that we took on visits to Florida in 2011 and 2015, a pretty comprehensive look at everything from Jacksonville south to Miami. That is all available for you on FiveWish.com. And FiveWish.com is also where you can go to get your hands on the brand new Hot Off the Presses 2018 Tower Site Calendar. That's going to be shipping within just a week or so, so check that out too. This has been Top of the Tower Podcast. I'm Scott Feibusch. We'll be back with you for another edition next week. Stay with us.